Our final case for this morning is case number 58968, Levi versus District Court Branch Banking. Again, Mr. Flansburgh for the petitioner, Mr. Sylvester for the real parties in interest. Mr. Flansburgh.
Frank Flansburgh of Marquis Harbaugh Coffing, representing Dr. Lavie, reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. May it please the court, the critical issue before you today is whether the statute acts as a time bar where there was no application for a deficiency filed within 6 months after the date of the trustee sale. This court has determined that that language is clear and unambiguous and looks for an application within that six-month period. This court also has consistently applied the statute as a time bar. In Shields, for example, there was a statutory claim that was outside the statutory time period, which was barred by this very statute operating as a time bar because it fell outside the period. Similarly, in Jameson, there was a claim for a deficiency that was filed outside the statutory period, which this court denied as time barred, applying this very statute. We also know that the legislature also confirms this court's interpretation of the statute as a time bar. When the legislature amends a statute without disturbing language that's been previously interpreted by the court, it's deemed to adopt the interpretation of this court. In 2009, the legislature amended this very statute and specifically adopted Section 3 of the statute. But what they didn't do was disturb the language in Section 1, thereby adopting this court's decisions in Shields and Jameson that this statute acts as a time bar. Moreover, in 2011, with respect to AB 273, the legislature addressed the six-month time bar because AB 273, there are multiple sections. Sections 1 through 3 of that bill specifically talk about junior mortgages and what happens in a short sale situation, for example, when the junior mortgage is foreclosed out. The legislature specifically extended the six-month time bar to the junior mortgages. So taken together, we know that the legislature adopts this court's interpretation of always treating this statute as a time bar where there is no application for a deficiency within 6 months after the date of the trustee sale. Furthermore, there's no actual notice exception within the statute itself. The plain language does not allow it. And this court consistently holds and elevates the plain language of a statute over any judicial construct of actual notice or otherwise. For example, in this court's decision in J.E. Dunn v. Chorus Construction, this court was faced with a similar question. There, the question was one of lien priority. That is, if actual knowledge of construction satisfied the statutory element of visible work of improvement or otherwise trumped that visible work of improvement. And this court said no. The statutory language is plain. It's been adopted by the legislature for decades, and it's been enforced by the court. The visible work of improvement is what the statute required. In this case, the statute requires an application within 6 months after the date of the deficiency.
Okay, Mr. Flansburgh, Walters versus District Court, it's 263 P. 3rd, 231. What impact does that case have on your argument here today?
Thank you, Your Honor. It confirms our argument today. Specifically in Walters, did a few things. Well, first, let me back up. Walters was a factually similar case. You had a pre-sale complaint, and then post-trustee sale, there was activity within the case, specifically a motion for summary judgment and a cross-claim for deficiency. In deciding that case, this court looked at 455, the statute at play in this instance, and held that that language clearly and unambiguously required an application within 6 months after the date of the trustee sale. And what the court did is not disregard the statute for actual notice because it was a pre-existing complaint. What this court did is look to what happened during those 6 months. It looked to see what was happening during those 6 months and determined that a motion for summary judgment that was filed within that window that asked for summary judgment and offset the credit bid of the property, thereby allowing a deficiency analysis, and also that there was a cross-claim, I believe, that was in April, also within the 6 months, that cross-claim sought a deficiency pursuant to the statutes, that those things were an application for a deficiency judgment pursuant to the statute. So therefore,
that's the rationale for the Walters decision. But its actual holding is not inconsistent with treating the complaint itself as the application, correct?
Correct. If the complaint is filed within the 6 months after the date of
the trustee. But the complaint is filed against a guarantor for the whole of the guarantee, correct?
Yes, pre-trustee sale, that's correct.
And there need never be a trustee sale to proceed against the guarantor so long as the guarantor is waived 40.430, correct?
There is no action against the property or otherwise to enforce their mortgage or lien pursuant to 495.3. That would be correct.
And indeed, if the creditor recovers judgment against the guarantor before there's a sale, the guarantor would succeed to the creditor's security rights in the property under 40.475, correct?
Correct.
So why is not the complaint, which pleads for the whole of the relief due under the guarantee, taken as including as a subset the lesser sum of the amount to be realized post-sale?
A couple issues I think are inherent in your question, Your Honor. First, someone who steps into the rights, for example, the borrower could assert all of the legal defenses against the guarantor that the guarantor themselves would not otherwise be able to assert in that instance. That's one distinction. Another distinction is the plain language of the statute, which we always go back to, requires an application within 6 months. This court has always interpreted that way. Moreover, when we look at an issue of notice.
But it's a lesser recovery than the creditor already sought by filing the complaint. And we're a notice jurisdiction. You file your complaint, included in it, fairly embraced within it are all the lesser included remedies, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the prejudice to my client, Dr. Lavie, is that one of the legal and equitable defenses available to us is the six-month time bar. And if they do not file an application within 6 months, which is undisputed they did not do in this case, then we have that legal and equitable defense that NRS 40.495.3 specifically provides us. So the prejudice to Dr. Lavie, if it suggested kind of no harm, no foul, if you will, Your Honor, that the prejudice to my client and to others similarly situated is that they're deprived of one of the specific legal and equitable defenses specifically provided by the statute. And I think it makes sense, Your Honor, because what we're talking about is notice and being put on notice of whether a claim is existing. Let's take, for example, a hypothetical situation if there was a demand letter made by the bank, that demand letter can be proved to have been served on a borrower or debtor, and it's specifically stated that they're going to seek to recover the entire indebtedness or even just a deficiency, and that was served within 6 months or before the trustee sale. But the application is not until after 6 months. Certainly that notice has no effect. The application would be time-barred. The same thing is true here.
Could you address for me one of the things that gives me pause with your argument that the complaint should not be treated as a sufficient application in the guarantor context where you have a waiver? But the second sentence of 40.495.2, the first sentence authorizes the waiver of the 40.430. The second sentence says if a guarantor waives 40.430, the action may be maintained separately and independently from, and then it lists four sub-paragraphs, an action on the debt, the exercise of any power of sale, any action to foreclose or otherwise enforce the mortgage, and any other proceeding against a mortgagor or a grantor. The briefs don't really focus on this, but in reading that statute, why wouldn't that take this outside the six-month time deadline, whereas here you have a pre-foreclosure sale complaint against a guarantor who's waived 40.430. Do you follow my question?
I do, Your Honor. 495.2 addresses a situation this Court addressed recently in Farrugia, and I know it's an unpublished order, but that's where the defense was waived and there was no action against the property, so the guarantor was subject to the full amount. But what's inherent in that statute is the very next section, Your Honor. And that's 495.3. That is, if a creditor maintains an action to foreclose or otherwise enforce its mortgage or lien and sues on the indebtedness secured thereby, then the guarantor has available to him all of the legal and equitable defenses set forth in 451 through 4639. The import of that, Your Honor, is that was the Shields compromise. The Shields decision applied guarantor defenses to, or excuse me, applied borrower defenses to guarantors completely. And the legislature in 1989 made a revision. And in 1989, they kind of compromised and said, look, if the creditor, if you're going to go after the property, you have to give them the defenses. But if you're not going to give them, if you're not going to go after the property, you're solely relying on the guarantor, 4952 will allow you to go after the guarantor exclusively. So my response in a long-winded way, Your Honor, is that 4952 is directed at that situation where they never go after the property. In this case, they went after the property, collected that property, thereby triggering 4953. So in conclusion, to saving time for rebuttal, statute's always been operated as time bar. There's no actual notice exception. This is a defense that cannot be waived. And because there is no application within the 6 months, that's from February 2010 to August 2010, unless they can point to something in the record that is a specific application during that period of time, the plain language as interpreted by this court as a time bar bars their claim. And the writ should issue. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Fisker.
Are there real parties in interest?
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, Jeffrey Sylvester on behalf of Branch Banking and Trust, as successor by acquisition to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The petitioner's position is that there is a requirement post-foreclosure to either commence a new action or to amend a pending action, and fail to do so is fatal to a claim for deficiency, and they are plainly wrong. We begin the analysis with what the purpose of the time limitation was in Section 40.455, and we can go back in time to 1969 when they first implemented the time period associated with bringing the deficiency action. And that was simply stated to avoid the factual scenario where there's been a foreclosure sale, but the statute of limitations on a contract or guarantee runs for another 4 or 5 years. The court would then be in a position and face the predicament of having to attempt to value the property as of a date of a foreclosure that occurred 4 or 5 years earlier. The court further stated the purpose of the time limitation in Jameson was to provide some stability to human affairs and to punish negligence. In this case, there is a waiver of the one action rule, clear and unequivocal. This case is governed by Section 40.495. The analysis that this court has to entertain begins and ends with reference to Section 40.430. In Section 40.430, it states, except in cases where a person proceeds under subsection 2 of NRS 40.495, there can be but one action for the recovery of the debt. And that action must be in accordance with 40.430 to 40.45.
Mr. Sylvester, I understand that. I just don't know how you get around Walters and the holding. The holding indicates if you file a pre-trustee sale complaint, you have to do it within the time period. You have to make an application. So it defeats that argument you just made.
With all due respect, I don't interpret Walters to be that way. I understand this was Walters was again a writ of mandamus where the court denied summary judgment. And the court affirmed Judge Denton's decision, where Judge Denton said two things. He said, one, there was an application within the six-month time period because mm-hmm. there was a motion for summary judgment. Independently, Judge Denton stated, and this court affirmed, that the pending guarantee action fell within the parameters of an application under Section 40.430. There were two different bases, and this court affirmed it. The court didn't state in its decision in Walters that you had to bring the action within the six-month time period.
I think it did say that. It said that the trustee sale was in December, and early April, 4 months within the 6 months, there was a motion to amend the pleadings here, and the motion to amend was to assert a specific cause of action for a deficiency, not a plain vanilla suit for breach of a guarantee, which was in the original complaint. It said you had to do that. Now, tell me how you get around that.
What I believe the Walters decision said was that those actions that occurred satisfy the requirement that an application be made. not that you had to file a motion or that you had to file a new complaint. And I want to talk just very briefly about the idea that the deficiency judgment is a cause of action or claim for relief. In reality, as in relation to a guarantee, a deficiency is a limitation on the amount of damages that may be received in the context of a breach of promissory note or a breach of guarantee action. It is not an independent cause of action or claim for relief. All you are doing is applying the statutory limitations on the amount of damages that you may recover in the context of a guarantee action. In a deficiency limitation, I still need to prove the elements of a breach of contract, or in this case a guarantee, that is the offer, acceptance, consideration, breach, and damages. Those elements have to be pled and proved in the context of an action to recover a deficiency. And so to suggest somehow that this the statutory scheme provides a brand new cause of action, I think, is to misunderstand, if you will, what you have to plead and prove to recover damages. It is nothing more than, if you look at the statute itself, a limitation on the amount of damages that you can recover in the context of one of those two actions. Also, as it relates to application, of course, application is not defined, but this court, on every occasion it has had to determine whether or not there's been a timely application, except for Walters, and Walters is a little bit different, has evaluated that in the context of when the complaint was filed. Whether it be Murphy or Walters or Jameson, it is a complaint that has been filed, not a motion for summary judgment within that time period.
Because counsel, if I could follow up on the point you just made, that's not what Walters said. Walters, in an effort to assess what was an application, specifically referred to NRCP 7B1 in analogizing an application to a motion. And it was that reasoning that resulted in the determination of the application being made within 6 months by vehicle of a summary judgment motion, not by way of the complaint itself.
Walters did not suggest that Judge Denton was incorrect when he stated as an alternative basis that...
So your position is the question of whether the filing of the guarantee complaint pre-foreclosure is still open under Walters?
I believe that it is. It is consistent with what this court did when it affirmed Judge Denton. Also, I don't believe that the argument with respect to 40.430 and the waiver of the one action rule and the commencement of the action was made or entertained by this court. I will note that in the absence of a complaint, this court is not going to have the ability or the district court to issue a judgment, because you may only have personal jurisdiction over an individual to the extent that there's a complaint and a summons that have been issued. If the idea is an application may be nothing more than a mere motion, it would fail under the procedural due process argument, because you would not have the personal jurisdiction to bring or to levy a judgment, if you will, against the borrower.
So is your argument that under subparagraph 3, under 4495, there's been no deprivation to petitioner's defenses because the suit was filed, obviously, well before 6 months, and the defense with respect to fair market value and assessing your damages is still available to him?
That's entirely correct, and that echoes the comments of Justice Pickering, is that it is a subset. There's an action pending for the full amount. They are entitled to and cannot waive the fair market value defenses under Section 453. They just simply can't do that. And they are entitled to receive those fair market value defenses. And in this case, they were entitled to and, in fact, presented fair market value defenses. 40.457 gives us the statutory mechanism by which we can protect the procedural rights of the guarantor in a pending action where foreclosure sale occurs, because that statute states that you must have a hearing, whether it be in the context of guarantee action or following a foreclosure, a new action, you have to have a 40.457 hearing before a judgment may issue. And so all of the defenses are available with respect to the fair market value.
But what about the six-month defense? His point is that 40.495 subparagraph 3 reintroduces, even for the creditor who's waived all the 40.430 stuff, reintroduces the whole panoply of defenses that are available under the deficiency section.
I think, Justice Pickering, if if there was a waiver of the one action rule and an action was not commenced by the lender within that time period, they would be time barred. But to the extent there's been a waiver of that one action rule and an action has been commenced, it satisfies the purpose, the salutary purpose of Section 40.455, and it's entirely consistent with 40.430 that it says, except where you are proceeding by virtue of a waiver of the one action rule and an action has been commenced, those actions must be commenced within that certain time period. My understanding with Section
40. I'd like to test that analysis just a moment, if I may. You made the point earlier in your argument that under 40.495.2, the lender can proceed against the guarantor for the full amount and obtain judgment for the full amount and not afford to the guarantor the defense of fair market value under subparagraph 3. Right?
No, I've never taken the position that the borrower or guarantor can waive the fair market value defenses. They are entitled to statutorily a limitation of the amount of damages by the fair market value defenses. The waiver simply says that the lender is not required to first look to the real property collateral before bringing a separate cause of action on a distinct contract. Mm-hmm. They are always entitled to the fair market value defenses. That's what the court said in Shield, and that's what the court said in Ferruzin. Understand that 40.495 was in response to Shields, because in Shields, for the first time, this court said that those defenses applied to guarantors, where it was previously unclear. In response to that, because of the chilling effect that would happen in the commercial lending situation, 40.495 was enacted so that there could be a waiver of the rights of the guarantor that were established under Shield, so the lender could look directly on that independent contract for the full recovery. 40.430, as it relates to the exception where a person proceeds under Section 40.495, also was in response to Shield, and obviously after 40.495 was enacted. The whole idea was let the lender look to the guarantor directly and immediately and not have to wait until there's been a foreclosure to recover that amount so that you can proceed directly and recover that amount. But never, never did the legislature intend, nor has this case ever suggested or this court ever suggested, that the borrower or guarantor can waive those fundamental rights of fair market value protections. They are entitled to that limitation on the amount of damages, and that can't be taken away statutorily. That's not what we're saying in this case. We're saying that there has been a waiver of the one action rule such that we are entitled under Section 430 to proceed directly against. And then that action is pending. To suggest that you would, after the foreclosure sale, have to amend or bring a second cause of action makes no sense in the context of the statutory scheme. It doesn't advance or further the purpose that underlies the time period of Section 40.455. You're not getting anything in addition. There are no additional affirmative defenses that you can assert that aren't otherwise available to you under Section 40.4953. You're entitled to all the equitable and legal defenses. The equitable and legal defenses include, but are not limited to, the fair market value. Every case that the...
Well, the only difference is under the post-AB 273 version of 40.495, the new subparagraph 4 now says you would measure fair market value at the date of the commencement of the action.
That's correct.
Which implicitly supports that there is no six-month time limit on the suit against the guarantor on a waived situation.
That's
correct?
Exactly right. And as you look to 40.495, again, this is a fully self-contained statute. This was designed to close that loophole that the court has reiterated in the Ferruzin decision.
But that doesn't apply to this case because it's...
No, it doesn't apply to this case. However, you can look to the statutory scheme in Section 40.495, and you will note that it states if an action is pending, they're entitled to the fair market value of the property as of the commencement of the action, and if a foreclosure sale occurs during the pendency of that, they're entitled to a fair market value. But what that statute doesn't say, and the statutory scheme never required, was an amendment to the existing guarantee action, because 40.495 presumes that there is an existing guarantee action. If it were to be interpreted as they had suggested, there would be some other mechanism or requirement within the fully self-contained statute to bring an amendment or a new cause of action. But that's not required because you're not alleging anything else. You're still alleging offer, acceptance, breach, and consideration and damages in the context of that action. What they are entitled to is now, as it has always been, the fair market value defenses, not a new lawsuit. Taking their argument to the next level, if you will, to the extent that the statute required a new cause of action and you were required to file a new cause of action, what would happen to the existing cause of action? Would it be rendered a nullity? Would it be simply dismissed? Because now you have two actions pending, both guarantee actions, one that just simply adds the fact that there's been a foreclosure sale, but the actions are identical. It doesn't require an amendment.
Well, I think at Walters, they had a suit for a plain breach of guarantee after they had the trustee sale, 4 months afterwards. They moved to amend to assert a specific deficiency. So that's a pretty easy fix to do within the 6 months.
Interestingly, that's not what happened in Walters, because in Walters, there was an amendment. But the amendment did nothing more than assert the identical cause of action for breach of guarantee against the guarantors. It alleged a deficiency against the borrower. That was a brand new cause of action, but the amendment didn't affect the factual allegations or legal arguments with respect to the action against the guarantors. They remained identical. And so in Walters, they had to amend because they hadn't brought in the borrower, and they amended to bring in the deficiency action against the borrower. They didn't change the facts against the guarantor in any regard. The point is that the purpose of Section 40.455 is to punish negligence and to add stability to human affairs. If you, as a guarantor, have been sued for the entirety of the obligation, you have stability in your affairs. You know what your liability is. And statutorily, by virtue of Shields and the further enactments, the lender can get no more than what it's entitled to, given the full market value defenses, the fair market value defenses that are available. And for those reasons, we would ask that the court simply deny the petition for writ of mandamus.
Thank you, Mr. Schlesinger. Klingsberg? You have 3 minutes and 52 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. The waiver argument by the respondent is just contrary to law. 4953 says, if you maintain an action to foreclose or otherwise enforce a mortgage lien, you get all the defenses, all your legal and equitable defenses at 451 through 4639. Not just 459, not just whichever ones they want us to assert, but all of them. In fact, the very position that respondent takes is contrarian. They take the position that we're always entitled to a fair market value hearing pursuant to 457, but what does the plain language of 457 say? It says before awarding a judgment pursuant to NRS 40.455, the very time bar statute we're talking about today. So even if you accept their arguments necessarily include the NRS 40.455 time bar. And it's also interesting that the position is different from this morning, from the same respondents, the same party, BB&T. This morning, the position was that their rights vest at the time of the trustee sale. Well, if their rights vest at the time of the trustee sale, which I don't agree with, by the way, but if that's the argument, then the pre-existing complaint doesn't do anything with respect to those rights that did not acquire until at the time of the trustee sale. They had 6 months to do something and file an application to comply with the statute. That's exactly what Walter says. It's a pre-sale complaint, a post-sale motion for summary judgment that gives an offset, a post-sale cross-claim for a deficiency within the statutory period. In this case, they have not pointed to and cannot point to a single place in the record in which there was an application within that six-month period. They admitted below at page 1330 of the record that there is no claim for deficiency in the complaint. It doesn't exist. And the reason it doesn't exist because they would have to make that application post-trustee sale, which they did not do. Taken together, this court has always applied 455 as a bar and would have done so in Murphy v. FDIC and had to reinstate the claim, not allow an amendment. That was also a pre-sale complaint. And this case matches up exactly with Walters with the exception of the lack of an application. And because that application is missing, we apply the language of the statute. The district court erred in looking to Utah law in evaluating Utah cases that have nothing to do with Nevada's deficiency scheme. Every time this court has addressed the statute, it's treated it as a time bar.
Well, out of fairness to the district court and opposing counsel, you know, Walters didn't come down until subsequent to your case. The district courts are not crystal ball readers, you know, but it's here now, so we have to deal with it.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. I remember scrambling in my answering brief or my reply brief when Walters came down. So you're absolutely right. The district court did not have available to it Walters. And because they're so factually similar and the court looked for an application to be filed within that 6 months, it doesn't exist here. There's only one and one result, and that's at this time bar. We ask that the appropriate rich issue. Thank you.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, of course, Your Honor.
If this lender had filed the complaint 2 weeks after, the identical complaint 2 weeks after the foreclosure sale, would you have deemed that sufficient?
That's a closer question. It's a much closer question, and I think Walters doesn't exactly
go ahead and finish.
Thank you. Walters doesn't exactly address it because Walters refers to the motion being an application and providing an offset and also refers to the counterclaim for the breach of guarantee, but also ties it with the cross-claim in which the claim was specifically requesting the deficiency. So there's a little bit of unsettlement there as to what the issue is, because the impact is as this court said in J.E. Dunn, for example, about actual notices, certainty and predictability.
Right, but I mean, let's make this very simple. Yes. You have a foreclosure sale and you have the same exact people and debt and everything that you have in this case. But instead of filing the complaint before the foreclosure sale, the lender filed the complaint after the foreclosure sale and filed the exact same complaint. What would be the result?
I think in that circumstance, that would most likely constitute an application under the statute. Although I don't think the law is clear on it, because in Walters, I don't think Walters...
But under Jameson and those other cases, that would...
Yeah, correct, Your Honor. In those cases, we don't know exactly what the language of the claims were, but it would be hard-pressed if there was the claim filed after that period, and with some distinctions with this case, because you know, what you'll see on page 61 of the record in the motion for summary judgment is we don't get any defenses, including offsets, which we assert in our affirmative defenses. So that, I think, would be a different case than the one we have here and would probably constitute an application. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Flansburgh. Thank you, Mrs. Sylvester. Both of you earned your oaths this morning, and Mr. Goldenberg and Mr. Oakes, all of you earned your oaths this morning. This matter will stand submitted. I want to thank counsel for their briefs in this matter and their argument. We're going to take a very short recess, and we'll bring Justice Shearing in and have the Legacy of Justice Award. We'll be in a brief recess.
Please be seated, folks. Make yourself comfortable.
We are in recess until the call of the court.
So we're going to bring her in this way.
Yeah,
we'll come in over there.
Yep.
Let me know when you're ready.
Yep. We'll see who wins. Thank you.
I
Justice Miriam Curing, and I thought it most appropriate that Justice Nancy Seda do this presentation. So, Justice Seda, it's all yours. And if you would join Justice Seda.
Please be seated. And let me start off by saying that I get the pleasure of making this award only by virtue of the fact that I am the chairperson of the Judicial Public Information Committee, and it gives me great honor every year to be able to present this award. A couple of firsts this year. First of all, we are being webcast. So everything that I'm saying, if I turn a funny angle, it's because Gang is going to be telling me to turn towards the webcast. So that's number one. And Miriam, you are, of course, the first woman to receive the Legacy of Justice Award. Having said that, the sentiment throughout the state was so widespread that everyone wanted to share this with you today, that that's why we've done the webcast the best we are able. And clearly, that's why our media partners are here. This is our 2012 Legacy of Justice Award, and as I mentioned, it's certainly been no secret that this has been presented this year to our friend and our colleague, Justice Miriam Shearing. Chief Justice Cherry recently commented that, and I think he couldn't have said it better, although at times I do disagree with his quotes, she shattered the glass ceiling in Nevada's court system. And I think there is no doubt that she did. And I certainly am eternally grateful that she did that for me. And although I know that our male judges are equally as proud of Miriam and her accomplishments, I will say, and I think it speaks for itself again, this courtroom packed full of successful women speaks to what you have done for all of us. And I just want to give you a few quotes. You know, of course, that statewide we have 34 of 82 district judges who are women. I'm proud to say that in Clark County, the numbers are a little bit better. And in fact, we represent one half of the district court judges. So 26 of the judges in the district court, the 52 judges, are women. 22 of the 67 JPs are women. 11 of the 30 muni judges are women. And I'm proud to say that two of the justices on the Supreme Court are females. Before I present this award, I'm going to talk about Miriam's accomplishments. So pick up your feet. This is going to take a while. I want to make something clear. We have stressed, and my comments in the next few moments will stress the fact that Miriam was the first female in many, many of her accomplishments. But I think one of the things that made Miriam so great is that she was a lawyer first. She never defined herself as a female lawyer. She was a lawyer, a judge, and a justice who just happened to be female. And I think that that's important, certainly, to many of us, because we don't want to be gender identified. We just want to be given an opportunity, as Miriam did for us, clear the way. So beginning in 1976, following a very successful career in private practice, Justice Shearing decided that she would become the first woman elected as a JP in Las Vegas. In 1982, she became the first woman in Nevada to be elected as a district court judge. Not only did she preside over civil and criminal cases, but she also served 3 years of her decade at the district court as the Clark County Juvenile Court judge. In that capacity, she was not only the judge, but she was responsible for administration of the agency that at the time, the Child Welfare Agency, was a division of the judiciary. Justice Shearing became the first woman to sit on the Nevada Supreme Court after her election in 1992. She served as the Chief Justice in 1997, again, a first. And finally, as her finale to her judicial career, at least as a full-time justice, she was the chief in 2004. As the Chief Justice, she helped reorganize the court. She moved the Supreme Court towards a paperless court system. And I'm quite proud to say, I suspect many of the lawyers who are here are equally as proud to know, that in fact that system is now fully implemented, allowing the court to handle cases faster and more efficiently. Although Justice Shearing has retired, and I'd like to put that in quotes, she isn't done with us yet. She still sits as a senior justice and a senior district court. That is just her local or statewide accomplishments. Obviously, these accomplishments have been inspirational for all of us. But she shared her expertise on the national stage, where she was once again an outstanding representative for all jurists, and most particularly for those of us who are females. From 2000 to 2003, she served as the national chairperson of the American Judiciary Society, a nonpartisan organization that works to maintain the independence and integrity of the courts. She also served as a four-state representative on the executive committee of the American Bar Association National Conference of State Trial Judges and the chair of the National State Federal Judicial Council. We're going to give her an award today that is certainly not as important in its weight or its presentation as the things that Miriam has done. And before I make that award, I want to make sure that I think what is equally as important to her is made reference to. And that is, she has her daughter, her two grandchildren here with her today, and she has always been able to balance the amazing accomplishments that she has done for our system with being, I think, a pretty darn good mom and grandma. And although her beloved husband, Steve, is not here today, I know that many of us have had the pleasure of standing by and watching Steve as he exhibited the great pride and great love that he had for his wife and for her work. The award itself, the Legacy of Justice Award, is presented annually to a person who, and I want to read this correctly because it's important, this is to a person whose career has resulted in significant and innovative improvements in the justice system so that there has been great benefit to the citizens of Nevada. That's a mouthful, but what it means is that she's gone far beyond just being a good judge. She has made a difference for the justice system and for the people who access that system. As I mentioned, this is the fourth time we've given this award. The first recipient was Bob Rose. The second was a dual award given to Judges Lehman and Breen. And in 2011, the award was given to Justice Cliff Young. I want you to know this is not a pick-and-choose award. This is an award that is nominated by and through the Judicial Public Information Committee, which is a broad-based committee made up of media partners, lawyers, judges, and then it goes to the vote of the Supreme Court. So it's a pretty hotly contested, I think, widely sought-after award, and no one deserves it more, Miriam, than you. It is a personal honor to me, and certainly an honor to this court, that I am able to present the Legacy of Justice Award to Justice of the Peace, District Court, Supreme Court Justice, retired senior Supreme Court Justice, Senior Judge Miriam Shearing, Mom and Grandma Miriam Shearing. It is my pleasure to make this presentation.
I feel so lucky. Thank you so much for this award. I feel so lucky, though, because the citizens of Nevada have let me do several of my dream jobs. And it's not that I grew up with the idea of being a judge. Matter of fact, I never even talked to a lawyer until I went to law school. Our small town didn't have that such things. But when I went to law school, I loved it, and I figured that's where I belong. But I really found my dream job after Judge Mendoza appointed me to juvenile justice referee job, and I saw, hey, this is the job I like, being a judge, making the decisions. And so that's what propelled me to go on and run for office, run for JP. That was fun because you're dealing directly with the people, not necessarily all these pesky lawyers. And then district court, that's a little more challenging. And juvenile judge, you feel maybe sometimes you make a difference. In fact, I have had grown men approach me in the supermarket and say, "Remember me? You gave me a chance on probation, and this is my family, here's my children." That's really what makes it a job. Anyway, it's been the Supreme Court. Then you get to delve into the law a little more carefully, and that had its own place, a little lonely sometimes, but otherwise I enjoyed that too. So, and now I'm getting the chance to go out into the rural areas. I've had trials in Yarrington and Elko and cases in Erie, and I get to see another part of the state, and that's been enjoyable too. So this is really on top of everything, a chance to have the dream jobs of my life. Thank you, Xander and Claire, for coming. You made a special day extra special.
This is
Claire, and this is Xander, who enjoyed every bit of the argument this morning. He was fascinated, and he asked the right questions afterwards to me, so he knew what was going on. And my daughter, Lori, the mother of Xander.
Did he say he wanted to be just like Dan Polzenberg?
I think, Chief, that if some of the colleagues would like to make comments or congratulations to Miriam, I think it would be appropriate for them to do so. No, stay. Come on.
Miriam, I'd like to congratulate you on this award. It is very much deserved. I had the privilege of following Miriam into seat C on the Nevada Supreme Court. One of the things that I will always remember is how that transition occurs from the district court to the Supreme Court. It's not an easy transition. And she was very, very helpful to me, my family, and all of us in making that transition. It was also kind of neat because I had an opportunity to read a bunch of stuff she left behind. Not really. She took most of it with her. But I was very grateful to how much she was of help to me. And as much as she has broken the glass ceiling for women, I think she advanced the cause of justice in all of her service to the judiciary and to the citizens of the state, and we're all very lucky for what she's done for all of us. Congratulations.
Well, Miriam, it's really a pleasure to be here. I mean, you're just such a great person and a colleague to work with. I had the pleasure of working with Miriam for my first 2 years on the Supreme Court. And one thing, actually, a little insight about Miriam, and I think Justice Douglas was there, and he wanted to hear today, but he's in Texas on the court interpreters thing. But Justice Douglas and I, the only ones remain in the court to serve with Miriam. And Miriam, one thing about Miriam, she runs the greatest meeting I've ever seen. Now, you're thinking, you've got seven Supreme Court justices, all type A personalities, all have strong opinions on all these cases. And sometimes they can get a little, go on and on and on. And boy, when she ran a meeting, she said, time to stop, stop. We got a long calendar, next case, we're done, you know, like that. And she's very assertive, and I thought just did a great job as a chief. And I know when I became chief, I tried to do that. I didn't have the success you did, Miriam, in doing it, but I tried to do it. But she's just was an outstanding justice here, and we're so pleased that she's continuing to work with us as a senior judge and justice on the Supreme Court. And we certainly wish Miriam the very best in the future.
I never got the opportunity to serve with Justice Shearing, but I did have the opportunity to appear in front of her on a number of different cases. And she was always prepared, always asked the best questions. Now that I'm sitting on the Supreme Court, I get the pleasure of reading a lot of her opinions, and you can see how much effort and care she put into them. They're principled and thoughtful and well-written, and I really appreciate that. On a personal note, I think although today we look back and nobody thinks anything of women in roles of the judiciary, but she really was a trailblazer, and it's the creation of that vision of what is possible and the courage to have undertaken that that has made such a difference to so many of us. And we are the direct beneficiaries of that. And so with all the women here, and I'm really delighted to see so many of our women judges here, we owe a big hand to Justice Shearing for having the fortitude to take this job on and to trailblaze. Even though she wasn't consciously trailblazing, she made a huge difference to so many of us, me included. So thank you very much.
Miriam, I also didn't get the pleasure of being able to serve with you. I was coming in right as you were going off, but for 30 years, I've watched you, and I've had the pleasure of watching you, and from a personal level, I have to emphasize what a gracious, elegant individual you are, and I've so much enjoyed being able to watch you and interact, so congratulations.
Chief Judge Taglianni, would you say a few words on behalf of all your judges, District Court and Justice Court and Municipal Court, please? I told Jen when she became chief it was going to be like herding cats, and but she's done a magnificent job. She did such a good job, she was just recently reelected Chief Judge.
Justice Shearing, on behalf of the 8th Judicial District Court and all the judges on our bench, all 52 of them, I want to congratulate you. You have obviously left a legacy on our bench, and you have sat in, I think, if not all the departments, a majority of the departments. And I believe you sat for me during my maternity leave. And, you know, sometimes you come back to work and it's a tsunami of a tidal wave, and I came back and it was smooth sailing. So on a personal note, because it's all about me, I really appreciate everything that you've done for our court as a senior justice. And I know it's not all about the women today, but you know, I stand here as chief judge of the 8th Judicial District Court, the largest court in Nevada, and if it weren't for you, you know, blazing the trail. It wouldn't have happened. And so, again, all about me. Thank you very much for everything you've done for our court and for our justice system and the judiciary. And we appreciate you and have great respect for you and everything you do for us. Thank you.
Say anything else? We can conclude the ceremony.
Only to say that let the award that we handed you not be indicative of how important this award is. The person who was supposed to carry the real engraved plaque forgot to carry it. So there's a lovely award that will replace that one somewhere. Thank you all. For those of you who are listening on the webcast, thank you for joining us. And again, I think we all owe Justice Shearing warmest congratulations for what she has done for our court system and for each and every one of us. Thank you, Miriam.
Please feel free to say hello to Miriam and her family. We're in recess until tomorrow at 10 o'clock. We're in recess, but please feel free to come up and give your remarks. Thank you.